Good morning. May I please the court? With me at the council table is Lieutenant Jones. And with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes.
Granted.
Before I begin, I'd like to note with an apology, a correction to our briefing. Our reply brief says, regrettably, in two places, that the military judge thought an objective outsider might find the web of relationships disturbing. In fact, that was the government. The citation is page 280 of the joint appendix. I apologize. The oversight is mine. There are two granted issues. I have 3 points to make on each of them. Some will take longer than others, and obviously I'm happy to respond to any questions the court may have. But with respect to the Article 25D2 issue, the threshold issue, which the court, the resolution of which is assumed by the grant, is whether the convening authority's exclusion of flag and general officers violated Article 25. Our position on this is that that's the law of the case. The government didn't cross-certify, so that's a closed aspect of the case. But logically, it's sort of built into the discussion. I wanted to make two very brief observations with respect to that piece of the case. The first is just out of curiosity, I tried to figure out roughly how many people were eligible who were flag and general officers. It's an interesting exercise. What you make of it, who knows? You may not have to deal with this at all. But this is what I concluded. Using, I don't think the numbers have changed materially, but using current numbers, there are 42 admirals listed on the Coast Guard website, one of whom is a public health service admiral. She's eligible because she's on duty with the Coast Guard. According to the permanent retired officer list, there are 153 retired flag officers in the Coast Guard, all of whom are eligible. There are, by my calculation, 1,074 active duty flag and general officers in the Defense Department.
Now, you've already indicated, though, that in your view, the law of the case is that you prevail on the substance.
Correct.
So the real question you have to deal with on that issue is there prejudice? Do we test for prejudice? And so on. And so what's your argument there? Why should you prevail on whether it was harmful or harmless?
Yes, there are two strings to our bow on that. One is that, in our view, you don't actually get to the harmlessness issue because of structural error. We have identified that as part of our contention, and I'll just briefly address that. I know there's been some discussion of structural error in the cases in the past. Our position on that is...
Was that raised below?
I believe it was at the CCA. I don't recall, actually, if it was raised at trial.
Is structural error within the scope of the granted issue?
Only in this sense, Your Honor. If there's structural error, you don't have to decide harmlessness. I mean, the case law has recognized that that's at least in the sort of range of options, the sort of doctrinal options. I'm flagging it. The only thing I want to say on that is it's really impossible to test for prejudice where you have a violation of Article 25D2. It's impossible to know who would have wound up on the panel had flag officers not been excluded. You can't voir dire somebody who hasn't been detailed. And it's impossible to know how member questions, deliberations, voting on findings or sense might have been different had there been flag officers on the panel. I'm finished with that.
But in the corollary of that is there's no apparent indication that there's actual unfairness. Are you contesting that in the end the panel was not qualified or not fair or some other thing, putting aside the second issue?
That's simply not part of the conversation if you're talking structural error.
No, I understand that. I'm not saying if you're talking harmfulness or harmlessness.
Right. The conversation turns to harmlessness, which is a matter as to which the government has the burden of proof, and our position is the government hasn't demonstrated that this error was harmless.
What about the fact that the panel that was seated did acquit the appellant of one of the two charges and that the punishment that they gave was
Utterly non-probative. My client stands convicted of a federal crime. He has been sanctioned. His position is that he should have been acquitted, and it's impossible. I mean, the government has to demonstrate that it would have necessarily come out the same way, and they can't demonstrate that. The things that the CCA relied on to demonstrate buttress their conclusion that this was harmless error really don't withstand scrutiny, and that's the heart of the matter. And
it's a burden of proof, and the government hasn't met it.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
And it's your point that, separate from this issue of structural error,
yes,
when you're dealing with a 25 violation of this nature, the government, in your view, could never prove harmlessness. Isn't that your point? And if they can, how could
in a pure harmless? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
How could the government prove harmlessness?
They can't prove harmless error. They can't prove harmlessness in cases of this character. There are other contexts in which, for example, if you had the auto pen problem, you know, convening authorities auto pen signed the appointing order, or the convening authority wasn't authorized. It was an ultra vires convening authority. I mean, you're in a different gear ratio at that point. But if you're talking about exclusion, particularly topside exclusion, but also bottomside exclusion, that there's no way for the government to be able to do that. And that, I think, is one of the shortcomings of the analysis that the court has developed over the last several years. I mean, these cases come up time and time again, and nothing happens. Article 25D2 has turned into a hollow promise as a practical matter. And the question is, at what point does this court say that's not satisfactory, that doesn't contribute to public confidence in the administration of justice? It looks like a formality. So
building on that, then, part of the issue here, then, is an appearance of unfairness rather than perhaps only actual unfairness that you're concerned about.
Well, certainly appearances are important in terms and particularly here's why, Your Honor. Everybody knows that the jury selection is one of those characteristics that most dramatically separates this system from the administration of justice in civilian courts. And I think that imposes on this court a special obligation of vigilance, because people who basically don't get the way this system functions are going to think that this looks like an empty guarantee, an empty assurance. And assurance, by the way, has been there since 1920. I looked it up. It was added in the 1920 amendments to the Articles of War. So let me say a few words about the harmlessness business. First of all, let me comment about Bartlett. Bartlett is on one level distinguishable with respect to harmless because the regulation there didn't actually exclude anybody on the basis of rank. There were other exclusions, but it didn't exclude anybody on the basis of rank. In addition, Bartlett was a guilty plea case, whereas this is the exact opposite of a guilty plea case. This is hotly contested, as the record demonstrates. The other thing on that subject is there is actually quite a, I don't want to say elegant, but there's a very simple way for the court to address the issue without disturbing Bartlett or getting into whether Bartlett's factors, which I'll address if I have time, ought to be revisited or reset in some way. This is a case in which the members were all in competition with the accused for promotion. I don't know of another case like this. The case may, for all I know, be a one-off. But there is, in this case, the basis for an extremely narrow ground of decision. Now, the government said...
Counsel, let's go back to that a minute.
Yes.
As to the panel members being in competition,
yes,
with Sullivan for promotion, was that the basis of a challenge at all?
It was not the basis. It was not, as I recall, the basis of a challenge, but it was a basis for the motion. And I can give you the references. It's page 413 of the joint appendix, and it's also noted on page 107 of the joint appendix. This was definitely one of the concerns. And
but couldn't he have challenged the members before they were seated on that ground? And what does that do as far as the prejudice argument is concerned?
It does nothing as far as this argument is concerned for this reason, Your Honor. On a challenge, the burden lies with the proponent of the challenge. On a violation of Article 25D2, the burden lies with the government. And to recast this as a matter of challenges, in fact, flips the burden of proof.
The problem with your argument is it then supposes that the appellant is entitled to have members made up entirely of flag officers.
No, that is not. The government suggests that, Your Honor, but that's actually not the case. The problem is that the convening authority took all flag officers out of consideration. Our position.
Is there a contention that you don't have to show that he did that for an improper purpose or with some animus?
No, we don't have to show that because the statute says the statute does not provide for categorical exclusions, which is what he did. And in that sense, the Bartlett concern does come into play. We don't have to show that. I think I've answered your question.
Well, I was trying to get you to turn to issue two, but
okay. The premise seems to be that if you're a flag officer, you're the best qualified. And I'm not so convinced by that. You may be the best qualified to be a flag officer, but does that mean you're the best qualified to sit on this court martial? Not necessarily. Leaving aside the promotion.
Right. Let me respond this way. Promotion boards. First, let me say that no real daylight between the promotion factors and the best qualified factors set out in Article 25D2. They're driving essentially at the same thing, I think. The words a little different, sure, but basically you're talking about the same thing. The notion that the higher up you go in the hierarchy through the winnowing process, where promotion boards see vastly more amounts of information about the officers they're comparing than does a convening authority who gets a printout that maybe lists advanced degrees, some of which may be incorrectly listed if you noticed in our reply brief. That kind of determination is vastly more rigorous and has a much more robust evidentiary basis than the kind of just going down a list with your pencil and saying, oh, she's okay, he's not okay, and so on. So I think, in fact, it's an a fortiori case that people who have been promoted to flag and general officer really are the pick of the litter. So we may not agree on that, but there it is.
Turning to issue two.
Yes, sir.
Are you aware of any other case where both the government and the accused have moved for the recusal of the judge?
I am not, Chief Judge.
Does that mean there are none or that you have not found any?
I don't know of any, and I haven't found any. And I think that makes this a most unusual case. And I will give you, I don't know, I guess I've got a couple of minutes left. Let me give you my thinking on this. First of all,
Well, let me ask you this question instead. Should we be applying the Liljeburg test of public confidence in the judicial process?
Absolutely.
And why should we or should we not be confident in the process here?
For the following reasons. First of all, because of the, and I say this with a mixture of dry-eyed perception.
You better say it quickly because you're on the clock.
Okay. The Coast Guard is a small service. Everybody knows it's a small service. This record is replete with evidence of intimacy and connections going back many, many years. The second thing is that, in direct response to your question, you would certainly want a firm evidentiary basis that is set forth by the judge at the time that would permit meaningful, intelligent appellate review, and that I don't think was provided here. And then finally,
this is a pretty open record, though. This is not a case where the judge's familiarity with apparently every single person in the Coast Guard was not on the record.
I'm talking about the other point of the documentation of what Judge Felicetti actually did to try to find a substitute. And then the third point, Your Honor, in response to your question is, Judge Felicetti effectively torpedoed whatever efforts he made by imposing two conditions on who could succeed him as military judge in this case, both of which were improper. The statute is perfectly clear that one judge cannot bind another judge on rulings.
But that presumes he was looking for another judge out of requirement rather than for prudential reasons, correct?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. That's true.
If you were correct on issue two, is it possible for the Coast Guard to court-martial an officer above 05 within its own service?
The Coast Guard would, the Coast Guard would depend. I don't know who the other judge is or how much of this would apply. There's another judge at the moment.
If we stipulate for the purpose of the question that all 06s know each other in the Coast Guard, as appears to be the case, at least in this case.
They ought to get a judge from another service.
So your view would be it's not possible in the Coast Guard under this system.
For a micro-jurisdiction, there are problems, and history reveals that over the decades, there have been occasional situations where the Coast Guard has been pinched by the fact that it's small. This happened in the Moorhead case. You know, the duties of a general court-martial judge, this is in the 70s.
So just to be clear, it's your view that if you were to prevail on that issue, on that ground, that would nullify the ability of the Coast Guard to perform courts-martials of senior officers?
Yes.
They'd have to
borrow a judge, and judges are interchangeable. They're purple.
Counsel, between issue one and issue two, which do you feel is your better argument?
They're both wonderful, Your Honor, but I think the first issue is the one that's more engaging. I think it's important. And also it has a very simple answer, the one I presented at the beginning, which is the government simply didn't carry its burden of proof.
Okay, your time is up. Thank you very much, counsel, and we'll now hear from the government.
May it please the court, good morning. My name is Lieutenant Commander Amanda Lee, and I represent the United States in this matter. The United States asked this court to affirm the findings and sentence because the exclusion of flag officers on the panel did not materially prejudice the substantial right of the appellant, and because the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he did not recuse himself from the case.
Could you speak up a little, Captain?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
When this court has considered the exclusion of a certain rank of officer or a certain qualification of member from the panel, it has primarily asked two questions. What was the motive of the convening authority, and what were the qualifications of the individuals that the convening authority actually did select? In this case, we know that the convening authority's motive was to avoid having members show up for the court-martial who would not be able to serve.
Just to be clear, do you agree with the appellant that the burden is on the government to show harmlessness?
Yes, sir. I agree with them under Gooch that because this is not a case involving command influence, that the government must show lack of harm, sir.
And so then you're saying there's lack of harm because there's no showing of ill motive and the folks were actually qualified.
Yes, sir. Under any of the factors that this court has looked at, in Gooch, in Bartlett, in Dowdy, and in Kirkland, the government can meet its burden, Your Honor, under any of those factors. But specifically with respect to the motive, the convening authority in this case was trying to pick members who would show up and would be able to devote themselves to this, what ended up being a lengthy court-martial, and what was always was going to be a lengthy court-martial.
Now, what if the convening authority were to say, I also know that 06s are very busy people, and were to just peremptorily say, I'm not going to consider them either?
Yes, sir.
How would that change your analysis?
That would still be error, sir, under Gooch. I mean, the possibility or even the probability of a conflict is not enough under Gooch to exclude a member. But if you look at the motive, was his motive pure in that case? Was it for the reason of sitting members? Was he trying to find a panel that
But then doesn't that really start to demonstrate the point made by appellant's counsel about the hollowness of Article 25? If any convening authority can simply say, I'm going to, right off the bat, disqualify these people from my consideration.
It doesn't, sir, if the motive is proper. And in this case, we have the testimony, well, the stipulation of testimony from the convening authority saying, that was my motive. And the military judge finding, I believe that the convening authority's motive was...
Okay, but we're talking about something a little bit different.
Yes.
What I'm asking is, why doesn't that render Article 25 hollow? It says the convening authority shall appoint. Where is there some mechanism to require convening authorities in the future to comply with that if this court were to say no harm, no foul?
Yes, sir, because this court has said in Bartlett and in Gooch there are factors to look at, and in this case the government can meet those factors. But even under the perception issue, sir, the appearance of fairness, under Kirkland, I understand that was something this court...
I want to try and get at this. You're arguing case law, which is a perfectly sound thing to do. I understand the question to be a bit more of a legal policy, which is, that's all great, but doesn't that gut Article 25? Put aside the case law, right on clean slate.
Yes, sir, I know.
You're correct. Bartlett, there you go. Now answer the question, which is, why doesn't that nullify Article 25?
It doesn't, sir, because Article 25, though it sets the criteria, you know, what we're looking for here, what Article 25 is driving, is a fair and impartial jury, to use the civilian term that the appellant used. Looking for a fair and impartial jury. And this is what we had in this case, based on the criteria of those that were selected.
So do I understand your answer is, because the goal here is to serve the purposes of Article 25, not to have a particular makeup of a panel? It's a question. It's not a statement question. It's a question.
Yes, sir.
Is that basically the argument, which is, so long as you have an a fair panel or whatever it is, a qualified panel, then you have done the requirements of Article 25.
Yes, sir, and then there you have an appellant, or an accused in that case, Your Honor, who has a fair and impartial panel to hear the case.
But Article 25 refers to best qualified.
Yes, sir.
Not to well qualified.
Yes, sir, and in this case, they were the best qualified, sir.
But how can they be best qualified when there was a group of people who were eligible for consideration who weren't considered? We're not talking about well qualified. We're talking about, under Article 25, best qualified.
Yes, sir.
How can you say that the 06s who were selected were better qualified than the flag officers who were not even considered?
Sir, because those that were selected met the criteria of Article 25, and just because a person is a flag officer does not make them best qualified.
You have a logic problem, don't you? If you don't know, there's never any comparison. The logic problem is they can't be best because you have to know who the other person is in order to say they're best.
Yes, sir, and we did have some... Yes, sir, but we do have some information in the record regarding the member questionnaires from the three flag officers who were originally selected to serve and then who were then excused due to operational concerns. So we have that in the record, Your Honor, but we also have the fact that there are many qualified individuals to serve on a court-martial panel, you know, from the rank of, with the exception of the lower two enlisted ranks, but E3 and above, we have many members qualified under the Article 25 factors. There was nothing about these panel members that made them unqualified. And the fact that they were not flag officers does not mean that they were not qualified or even the best qualified under Article 25.
If the convening authority, does it matter that the convening authority took those three flags and said, well, I know they're awful busy, so, you know, I want people who are going to show up for this thing, and I'm going to assume they're not. Bang, you're gone. As opposed to looking into their schedules individually, you know, what are you going to be doing in the next 30 days, that kind of thing. Why doesn't that make the difference between error and non-error?
Sir, I think it does. And in this case, the convening authority said in the stipulation of testimony, I didn't ask any individual flag officer for his availability. So I think had he done that, sir, I don't think certainly the government would have.
You're arguing harmless.
You're arguing harmless. In other words, you're saying that's the error.
Yes, sir.
But it's harmless because.
You represent the United States, correct?
I do, yes, sir.
And is it the United States view that flag officers are too busy to be bothered with matters of military justice?
Not at all, sir. And they could have been, at least their schedules, inquired into, Your Honor. And I'm guessing that some of them would have been too busy to serve or have operational concerns, sir. But under Gooch, the question should have been asked.
Do you happen to know what the United States Coast Guard policy is on flag officers serving on courts-martial?
I don't believe there is a written policy, sir, that I'm aware of. No, sir.
Could I follow that up and just ask that under your theory, it appears that the Coast Guard could adopt a policy that says that flag officers are just too busy to sit on courts martials, and so they're not going to be considered. Because that is what you're arguing without a regulation.
Yes, sir, but what I'm arguing is that, well, it's likely they would have been too busy, sir. The commuting authority had to ask the question, and he didn't. And under Gooch, which this court decided 18 months later, after the commuting authority made the selection, that was error. But even though we have error, as we did in Bartlett, as we did in Dowdy, as we did in Kirkland, as we did in Gooch, that doesn't end the discussion. And the discussion is then, what other things do we have to look at? And in this case, we have the qualifications of those members that were selected. We have the benign motive of the convening authority, a proper motive of his desire to seat a panel that would not be excused during voir dire because they said that they could not be available for the 13-day trial. And the other factors we have under Bartlett, you know, whether the members were fair and unbiased. And we have evidence of that in the record. They were voir dired on this. There's extensive voir dire. They were given an opportunity to say they could not be fair or that they could not be unbiased, and they did not do so. We have, as Your Honor's pointed out, we have an acquittal on one charge. We have a relatively benign sentence, the term the CCA used for it. But we have 279 questions in the record of the things that they asked, none of them betraying favoring one side or the other, none of them betraying the fact that they were fair and impartial. And with respect to the issue of the promotion potential, that was never explored during voir dire. It was raised in the brief for the motion to recuse made by the appellant, but never explored during voir dire. But the members during voir dire did say, I will be fair, I will be unbiased, I have no reason, you know, to not sit on this case, and I can sit in judgment of this individual. We also don't know what they were thinking. We don't know if had the question been asked, we might know if they actually felt they were in promotion to flag officer. I'm sure within the other services it's the same thing, but in the Coast Guard there might be 227 officers eligible for flag, but a very small percentage are actually really in consideration. And the more important question here for the members would have been, do you think you're in consideration for flag? Or do you think that the appellant was in consideration for flag? I mean, this was an officer who was in charge of the counter-drug operations on the Pacific Rim, and he was accused of cocaine use. Now, undisputably, he has the right to a presumption of innocence, but that does not necessarily mean that a flag officer panel would look at him and say, well, he was acquitted, and therefore he's going to be eligible. So these are the questions that had the appellant explored that on voir dire, we might have gotten to the question of whether the members were fair, and we would have gotten their answers on that as to whether they thought they were in competition. But what we do have on the record is the members saying, I can be fair, I am not biased, I know of no reason I cannot sit on this case, and that's what we have under Article 25. And he had a qualified panel, and he had a fair panel. And with respect to the perception of fairness, which this court was considered in Kirkland, we have the convening authority in this case going to great lengths to seat a panel that he believed would be able to sit and hear the case.
What protects future accused if it is in fact Coast Guard policy that flag officers are too busy to be bothered with trivial matters in military justice? We don't know because it's not clear. What protects a future accused in a case where the people who are panel members are qualified? It seems that the accused always loses.
No, sir. I don't.
As long as you can come in here and argue good motive and good qualifications, then we can just say the following people are always too busy to be troubled with these matters. 06s, 07s, people who live on my street, as long as you end up with qualified people. And apparently the government has a stronger view about 06s than they do about 07s in the Coast Guard. because 07s come across as a bunch of hotheads who you wouldn't want thinking about anything, including how to steer a cutter.
Yes, sir.
That's just another aside.
Yes, sir. 2 points, sir. It's not the Coast Guard's position or the United States position that you can exclude flag officers or any type of person with a blanket exclusion. Again, that is error under Gooch. So to the extent,
but it is error, but your position is and
it's meaningless.
We're piling on. I'm copying his question, Judge Olson's question, which is, as long as you end up with good motive, and the good motive appears to be flag officers are really busy people, and the people who actually serve are qualified.
Yes, sir. And what I would say, sir, is that this court has, and I understand that this court is asking the question, but this court has previously said there's
right,
factors
and it's fair for you to read us back our own opinions. I get that part.
Yes, sir.
But that doesn't mean I can't ask you the question, which, notwithstanding our own opinions.
Yes, sir. Absolutely, sir. And I think that one of the points would be what I've made earlier with respect to what the appellant is entitled to, and that's a fair trial. And that's what he got in this case, Your Honor. But also, I think the motive is important, Your Honor. And it's also important to point out that Gooch wasn't decided when this decision was made. So going forward, now the military judge hearing the same motion from the appellant, or from the accused, rather, and accused, will have that information available to him. Hey, no, you got to ask. They might be too busy, and they might give you a laundry list of reasons they can't do it, but you've got to ask. And we have that now. And going forward, a military judge would be able to better assess the situation, and the government would undoubtedly be able to advise the commanding authority better when the SJ has that information.
On issue two,
yes,
are you aware of any case where both the government and the accused move for the recusal of the judge?
I'm not aware, no, sir. And I've looked at it, but
was it the government's position the judge should have been disqualified?
It was that position at trial, Your Honor, but it's not our position here for two reasons.
Yeah, I mean, why?
For two reasons, Your Honor. One, the reason, one of the key reasons the government gave for recusal of the military judge was this issue that the prospective panel members might know him and would be unable to follow his instructions. The Coast Guard Academy class, with the
you can't follow your classmates' instructions.
Yes. And unfortunately, sir,
that's an interesting proposition.
Unfortunately, sir, that was what one of the potential member questionnaires indicated. He said, I know the military judge, I consider him a very good friend, and the next question was, would you be able to follow his instructions? And he said no. Now, I'm hoping he misread the question. I'm hoping that my friends would not say that I cannot be trusted. However, that raised a problem with the government, because there was a limited number of people who could hear this case, or who could sit on this case, based on the senior rank. And therefore, it was important that they be able to sit a panel. So they wanted to remove the military judge because they were concerned the members would not be able to follow his instructions. And the military judge came back and said, that's not the case law. The case law is that if my instruction cannot be followed, then that person is recused. And so the government's position on this case, while I respect it greatly, was incorrect. And so, therefore, it is not a problem that the government moved for the recusal, and here we're saying there's no error.
So
I'll go after you.
You just said that one of the primary reasons for the government seeking recusal of a military judge was the issue you just addressed. So are you conceding that part of the issue that the government cited at time of trial was because of actual bias on the part of the military judge or appearance of unfairness?
Certainly not actual bias, Your Honor. The government never alleged there was actual bias.
So what are you saying was the other reason for the government seeking the recusal of the military judge?
It was the number of contacts that he had, sir, not the sufficiency of the
So it was the appearance of unfairness?
Yes, sir, it was.
Solely that point?
Yes, sir, it was. But now, with respect to that position as well, I mean, the government is obviously very protective of the record. I mean, the government is going to try to avoid an appellate issue, so perhaps if the trial counsel viewed this with a more objective lens rather than trying to protect the appellant record, or the record here, he might have come up with a different decision. But also, the question here is whether the military judge abused his discretion. So there's not a de novo review, so it is whether the military judge abused his discretion.
Counsel, do you think that the case would be in a different light, or that your position would be weakened if this had been a trial before the military judge only, as opposed to a trial before members?
No, I do not, Your Honor. I don't believe it was. I believe that the record is very clear that the military judge found himself not to be actually biased, found there was no appearance of bias, and that he was able to hear this case. And he was very clear on that, Your Honor. And I don't think any of his rulings, he acknowledged that it's illegal to to not, you know, to take his own promotion into consideration, which is an issue that was raised by the appellant in his brief. He knew what he was. He knew he had to follow the law. He said, "I will follow the law. None of my connections will in any way interfere with my ability to hear this case."
I want you to focus on the question, though. If this had been a judge alone trial, where both parties had moved for his recusal, would that change, in the government's view, the concerns presented or the outcome?
No, no, sir. It would not. I believe that a judge alone trial, he would have equally been not abuse his discretion if he sat on the case, Your Honor, because of the explanation that he gave on the record, the very lengthy explanation explaining why he was, there was no appearance of bias, Your Honor.
We're operating under a uniform code of military justice, and this is a please comment essay, because I'm not sure how to present it in the form of a question. I'm not even sure it's a question. But if this were in the Army or the Navy, where there are more judges, one gets the impression that this would have been booted quickly to another judge, but not in the Coast Guard for various reasons. How does that square with what is supposed to be a uniform code of military justice? Putting aside partiality, we'll stipulate for the purpose of the please comment question that there's no question of partiality, everything's wonderful, everybody's Article 25 qualified and happy about it, but why should it be that in the Coast Guard you get a judge, everybody refers to each other as Tom, Dick, and Harry, as they did in the record, and in the Army or the Air Force or the Navy, you would be sent to another judge in a heartbeat?
So I have two responses, sir. First, the military judge never on the record used a first name. That was the SJA referring to potential panel members. So Don and things like that. I believe he signed an email to the head of the Coast Guard Investigative Service with his initials, but he was not conversing with them on a first-name basis, and certainly not on the record. So in that respect, there's that, Your Honor. But also with respect to the size of the Coast Guard, the military judge at the time was the only general court-martial military judge. However, he had previously recused himself when he was unable to serve. It's in the Joint Appendix at 55, he described a situation where he said, "I'm not biased, but the appearance of bias here might be an issue," and he recused himself. So we have evidence that he's done that before, and evidence in the records that have come since that the military judge has not been afraid of recusing himself or herself if there's an appearance issue. So we have that, Your Honor, but we also have the fact that when you're looking at the standard, it's a reasonable person with knowledge of all the facts. And a reasonable person with all the facts understands that the Coast Guard has 200 judge advocates and the Army has 2,000. And so while there might be more contacts in the Coast Guard because it's a small community, that doesn't change the sufficiency of the contacts. The fact that there were no personal contacts here except for one relationship with the accused 21 years prior and no contact since. But a reasonable person would look at all of those factors, Your Honor.
So you're arguing that there should be no special rule or consideration for the Coast Guard?
No, sir. No, sir. And, of course, the appellant's entitled for a fair trial no matter what service he signs up for. But there is no special rule, and the Coast Guard can't handle
it. So the uniform aspect is the fair trial, not the military judge assignment process.
No, yes, sir, and obviously having a military judge from another service, we've used it, the Coast Guard has used it in the past to success, but they did not do that in this case, and I see my time is short, so I'll just summarize under the Liljeburg factors. Even if this court finds he should have recused himself, there's no actual bias in the record. The appellant stated it many times at 110, 111, 115, 116 of the record. No prejudice, no appearance, and no appearance problem because of the extent that the military judge went through to discuss this situation with a reasonable person. No further questions, Your Honor.
Yeah, we have a further question here.
Can we just jump back to issue one for
yes,
one
sir.
Moment? What's the government's position about whether structural error, that argument, is covered under the scope of the assigned issue?
Sir, we don't believe it was. It was not raised in the court below, and it was raised here as a throwaway, but also this court didn't grant on that, Your Honor. And that's why we didn't brief it.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the appellant, please, you have rebuttal opportunity.
Thank you, Your Honor.
What constitutional right is implicated?
I'm sorry, I'm not.
What constitutional right is implicated by Article 25 that we would tie a structural error ruling to?
It's not a constitutional right, Judge Ryan. Yeah, there's not a constitutional issue in this case.
Thank you.
The one thing that I wanted to invite the court's attention to is on page 5 of the Joint Appendix. This is the opinion of the Court of Criminal Appeals, And I'm looking at the last three sentences. They're short. This point was not developed at trial. This has to do with the fact that the members were in competition with the accused for promotion. It may not have been developed at trial. It was raised at trial. There's no question that it was raised at trial. It's right in our motion papers. The government's brief changes the word developed to raised, which is not correct. The CCA then says, whether the members likely or actually saw themselves as being in competition with the appellant is speculative. We do not believe it rises to a level that precludes a finding of no harm. The first part of that is the government's problem, because the government had the opportunity to develop this issue. It was, where you're talking harmlessness, that is the government's burden, not our burden. So that, the government has to pay the freight for the fact that the record is not developed on this. It's their record that they need to be able to point to, and they can't point to it. And then the most interesting clause in this paragraph is, we do not believe it rises to a level that precludes a finding of no harm. And as I read that, I think the CCA was flipping the burden of proof. The burden of proof is on the government. I don't know how they got to that point in their thinking, but if you read that clause, it's a freestanding sentence, except it's separated by a semicolon. They're clearly not talking about the burden of proof being on the government. There was some sense, according to whoever, to Judge McClellan, I guess, Chief Judge McClellan, that it was incumbent on us to present evidence to preclude a finding of no harm. And I'm here to tell you that that is a distortion of the burden of proof being on the government to demonstrate harmlessness. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The court thanks both counsel, or all counsel, and the case is submitted, and we'll stand in recess until 10 o'clock, please. Thank you.